There are various science fiction movies in which you have a plot in which some machine or some robot is created, and then after a time, that entity develops a will of its own and tries to rebel. It's not a genre that I enjoy all that much, so I don't watch it, but I know how the whole thing works. Something's created to be one thing, and then it takes it in a completely other direction. When I was in high school, one of my classmates happened to be an extremely talented man in many aspects of theater, and in fact, he went on to be an award-winning set designer in New York and Los Angeles, John Beatty. He's not famous unless you're in that field, but he was very well known, is. And he had a particular passion for marionettes. He had very, very supportive parents who just whatever ideas he had, they just made it happen for him. So he made these beautiful marionettes, and then he would do shows for children and various places where he could, and I became one of his partners who would work the puppets with him. And we did the puppets without a stage. We just did them like this, just walking around. And we just wore black clothes, and we were the voices of the puppets like this. And when John took me out the first time, I said, "John, this is ridiculous. I mean, everybody's just going to be looking at us." He said, "No, you'll see." And he was absolutely right. We just carried them out, and they were, of course, beautiful and interesting, and nobody looked at us at all. I mean, not even the adults. We would just move the marionettes and speak for them, and everybody would just watch the marionettes as if it was really happening from there. Its perception was a certain, we were oriented, people were oriented in a certain way. It had nothing to do with reality. The other day, just before service came out, Helen pulled out of her purse a little baggie full of finger puppets, just these little knit things that apparently she collects carefully for the preschool teacher, who will only accept the best. So these were the best finger puppets, a little pony, a little duck, you know, a little fairy, a little butterfly, and I put them on my fingers, and Gary tried to have a serious conversation with me. But I had suddenly become all of the five finger puppets, and they were able to say and do things that I wouldn't have been able to do. I became quite cheeky and rather rebellious to everything that he asked of me. And even though they were my own fingers and my own voice, they had a reality of their own that was just happening there. And of course, this is why they do them for children. You can say things often when they're doing therapy for children. They'll use puppets or dolls or finger puppets, because sometimes the child won't talk to the therapist but will talk to the puppet, even though the puppet is right there. Now, everyone is always trying to understand how we can be made of the power and the presence of God, how we can be nothing but a pure expression of the divine, how this whole world around us can be nothing but a pure expression of the divine, and we don't notice. I mean, many people don't notice for many, many incarnations. By the time you've walked in here, at least something has crossed your mind that there's something fishy about the way this whole thing looks, and we're beginning to try to get in there and understand it. There are many verbal explanations of how God created the world, why he created the world. I can repeat some of them, but I don't have any idea what I'm saying. An interesting one I read recently was, Swami said, the idea arose in the mind of the infinite to create you. And then that thought became a causal vibration, and then more energy was added to it, and it became an astral vibration, and finally it became a material body, which is where we are. Doesn't really tell me any more than I knew before I read it, but I thought that was sort of a fun way of thinking about it. But just like the computers that we create that suddenly take a turn and go somewhere they weren't programmed, so it is with us. We just get started in this certain direction. Now, if I could always remember that the finger puppet on the end of my finger is just an extension of me, and even in the little final tip of it, if I could always remember where I came from. But what happens to us is because it becomes familiar, we begin to lose track of where it's coming from, just like we move the marionettes. And it should be obvious, but the children watching lose track. And we're the children watching. We're watching ourselves, we're watching everyone else, and we just lose track. We lose track of what the point of the story was, even. We forget where we are. We forget what we're doing. Sometimes you, just a moment there. I became confused by the circumstances and I identified with the wrong thing and I lost the thought. That's what happens to us, is that we identify with the wrong aspect of it and we lose track of why we're here, where we're going, what we're supposed to be doing. In the Festival of Light, every single week in the Festival of Light, we trace out that saga of the little bird. It starts as a manifestation of God. It gets involved in the experience. And it begins to define its own pleasure in its own way. And then what happens is this pride comes into the story. And that, who are you to tell me? I know better. Isn't that what it's like all the time? Swami Kriyananda talked about his samskaras as a writer, his past life memories of being a writer that were present even when he was very small. He says when he was 6, he wrote some little story, and like children do, tying every sentence together with the word and. So he wrote this long sentence, and his mother looked at it and said, "Well, honey, that's very nice, but maybe you don't need all these ands." He said he was 6 years old, and he thought, "And who are you to tell me how to write?" Because it was already deeply in him. That's who he thought he was. And so the little bird in the Festival of Light, it has this idea, who are you to tell me? But this feels good to me. This feels wonderful. And in the Festival of Light, we talk about how we were inspired by God to consider ourselves part of the greater reality. But we began to have this very individual experience, and we liked the experience of the things that made us feel bigger and feel better. And so we began to lose interest in this connectedness. We began to lose interest in it, and we began to assert, this is where happiness really comes from. And in the Festival of Light, it says, and even though repeatedly we lost everything we had, we cling to this idea. Now I remembered the thought I was going to say. Our true nature is to be one with all, for you are a part of all that is. Again, in the Festival of Light, we say this over and over. Pray for the grace of for others to receive as you have received, for you are a part of all that is. We affirm that for many different reasons, because when God began to think of us as an individual, whatever that means, and manifest us through these various stages of individual expression until we inhabit a unique physical body, what happens to us is the more we identify with that unique separation, the more lonely and incomplete we feel. Because somehow or another, we have cut ourselves off, literally, from our actual source. And so in the Gita, it explains, and it's really a very interesting and subtle thought, we become restless. And so desires arise. And that fundamental desire is, I feel incomplete. I feel insecure. I feel unfulfilled. And so Rajoguna is how it says, the restless energy within us starts trying to find a way to feel fulfilled and to feel complete. And this world is set up perfectly, especially this particular corner of this particular world, is just set up perfectly for anything that we can imagine that might complete us. I'll dye my hair, I'll get the shape of my nose changed, I'll get a great, big, expensive car, and then everybody will think I'm really important. I'll build a bigger and bigger house, and I'll just keep buying stuff. Just stuff. At the Spiritual Renewal Week recently, the community manager, Atman, his name is, he gave a talk, and he gave all these statistics that I don't know, but here's the only piece of it. The biggest, fastest growing real estate segment in the country is self-storage units. I mean, what does that say? Recently we had to move all our legal boxes from our lawyer's self-storage unit because they just doubled the rent on his unit, and he decided it was finally time to get rid of it. Simultaneously, houses are getting bigger, closets are getting bigger, garages are getting bigger, families are getting smaller. But still, we don't have room. Fewer number of people don't have room in their bigger houses for all their stuff. What is wrong with this picture? But you see, the Gita takes it, doesn't just talk about advertising or television or movies or anything. It goes all the way back to as soon as we are separated from our source, we begin to feel unfulfilled, insecure, incomplete. That's such a wonderful word, isn't it? The word incomplete. And you'll hear men say, I don't feel complete without a woman. You'll hear women say, I don't feel complete without a man. You'll hear people say, I don't feel complete unless I have a family. I don't feel complete until I own a home. And all of those impulses are just that very fundamental desire within us that we know we are separate from where we are meant to be. And let me try this, and let me try this, and let me try this, and let me try this. And in all of that chaos and confusion, the little voice of spirit, the little voice of the divine, just gets sort of more and more and more and more buried. Literally buried under all that stuff. I'm very little familiar with the principles of feng shui or vastu or any of those things. But I am familiar with the concept that things hold energy. And that energy interrupts the flow of our energy. One of my friends who taught me about feng shui, and it's the only thing I know and it's the thing I still do, she says, hold your physical things in your hand one at a time and see whether they give you energy or take it away. You have a house full of things that when you touch them, they make you feel ambiguous. You know, oh, I never really liked that. Oh, all those clothes are too small, but I'm going to lose the weight. All those clothes are so big, but I may gain the weight back. Right? That's how I used to wear my hair, but I can't really, I have a bum knee now, I can't really ride my bicycle, but maybe I'll get my knee back. You know, just over and over. My Aunt Ethel gave this to me, and I've never liked her or the object. But if my mother knew, I threw it away. I mean, look at it. And where is the little voice of spirit saying, who am I? Where does my happiness come from? What do I really need in this world? And in the Gita, it talks about intellect, mind, and senses, and how the intellect, the mind, and the senses are really what Jesus was referring to. This gets very esoteric, but it's very true. All those who come before me are thieves and robbers. Now, Jesus isn't talking about I, Jesus, the one who should be recognized, and you know, John the Baptist, or whoever you might be, who are taking away from me, Jesus. He's not speaking. It's nothing to do. He is not identified with his individual material body. That's our game. That's not his. When Jesus would say, I, he meant the Christ consciousness. He meant the completeness of who we really are. He meant unity with divine spirit. All those who come before, which is to say in front of, which come between, you know, my individuality and my awareness of my completeness in spirit, they steal from me. And what do they steal from us? Our happiness. Our sense of fulfillment. They send us on this endless quest. They drive us to just go out and keep looking. There's the legend of the musk deer. Whether the musk deer is a true thing or not, I don't know. At a certain season, there's a gland within the animal himself, which it releases an intoxicating fragrance. And the animal runs everywhere seeking for it and often will, you know, crash into a tree or go over a cliff and actually take his own life seeking for the source of that intoxicating aroma which is actually emanating from himself. It's too obvious, isn't it? And in a very rajasic, which is to say restless and active age like the one we're in now, where we are shifting from a materialistic concept of creation to an energy concept, but have not quite made the shift, what we have is all this stuff and more of it energized with the new age. So it's just stunning. I mean, it's really stunning. Sometimes I'm just fascinated by, I'm part of it, I just love it. But the incredible creativity of people. Yesterday, for the first time, or the day before, I took a little pious pilgrimage to the Container Store, a reality that I knew was always there, but I never actually had the opportunity to stay in, to go in. I loved it. It's just so full of stuff to put your stuff in. Which, of course, then makes it much easier to keep track of it all, to see it in all those coordinated jars and coordinated boxes and so on. But it's the natural outgrowth, and it's very creative. I mean, if there's money in it, Americans will find a way. That's our greatness as a country. I absolutely love it, and we're able to do it. But really, what are we looking for? So we go back to the senses, to the intellect, to the mind, and they come before, they come between as a shadow of ourselves and our actual completeness. The senses are the beginning of it. When God had this thought, it was a diabolical joke, which I suppose is not really, you can't really say God had a diabolical idea, can you? But anyway, he did. It goes out in this way. The satanic force is what pulls us out in a metaphysical sense. And it all comes out through our senses. I mean, if any of you have ever been at the birth of a child, as soon as the child is born, the child begins to relate and look around to the world around it. Reach up. I watched little Leia Mahoney when she was about 4 minutes old, reaching up and taking the hand of her father. I mean, it was just, you know, heartrendingly beautiful, and we were all just little tears running down our faces. It was so sweet. But another part of me thought, look at that, you know, minutes old, just reaching out. Because here we are, on our own again. Master said that's why babies cry when they're born. It's not because of having to breathe on their own. It's because as soon as they take that breath, they realize where they are and what they've done. And they wail. It's interesting. Ananda Moyi Ma, a great saint in India, she died in 1982. And she said, she remembered, she was entirely conscious through the whole process of even gestation and birth, all the way through. She never lost self-awareness ever, because she was never identified with this limited being. Just as I'm playing the little puppet over here, there's nothing separate and real about this little knitted pony here. It's always myself. And so there's really nothing separate and real. This is no more different. We are a finger puppet on the hand of God, if you want to think like that. And Ananda Moyi Ma was always conscious of where she'd come from. And she could see where she was. And she could animate the body that she'd been given. But she never identified with it. She never let anything, never let her senses, never let her mind, which is her mind is just perceiving and identifying, never let her intellect, which gives meaning to all of these things, false meaning to all of these things, she never let that come between her and the Christ consciousness. So when she was born, it was said, well, it was true, she didn't cry, she didn't reach for anything, she was born completely serene, and just lay there perfectly still. And what she said later was, I was looking out the window at the beautiful trees. And she was an infant, minutes old, and she was just complete within herself. She never allowed mere birth to create within her a sense of separation. You see, and that's what we're trying to do. Merely because we're born, merely because we live in these bodies, merely because we are responsible now for this incarnation, because the example of the saints is not that they don't participate. Sometimes people twist spirituality And they think if they rebel against what's asked of them, they refuse to learn, they refuse to put out energy, that somehow that's being more detached. But that too is a false understanding. We are here for one reason and one reason only, and that is to be an instrument of the divine in all that we do. And what is the nature of the divine? Giving, selfless giving, unconditional love, divine support, divine acceptance. That's why the saints and the masters live, to show us what that's like. I mean, that's what Swami Kriyananda was like. That's what Master was like. And in the Festival of Light, we speak of the masters coming into this world. Here, then, is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey, to sacrifice everything to help others. But then, it's no sacrifice. It's simply the way that we're made. Pray too for the grace to share with all as you have received, for you are a part of all that is. So we see in the lives of these masters this constant idea, how can I give? How can I give? How can I help? You know, how can I be an instrument? How can I support? How can I help others grow in their divine understanding? The senses tell us that pleasure through this body and having what we want and getting this beautiful thing and hearing this sound and speaking these words, all of these things, it tells us that that's reality. The mind then gives, as I said, meaning to it. It identifies it. This is me. That's you. And this is, of course, me. There's a movie that I loved with Steve Martin in it, and it just was one of his goofy scenes. And he was talking, he was a movie director who was hoping to be famous in this very exaggerated way. And he had a group of people who were working with him, but actually for him. And he was trying to promote, get them all to be on the team. And he talked about how we will do this, and then we will receive this, and we will be famous, and we will be rich. And then in his way, he just smiled and he said, and when I say we, I actually mean me. Just like that. And it was such an exaggerated view of what is always going on inside of us, isn't it? Because the mind says, well, what about me? What's in it for me? And even though repeatedly we lost everything we had, we hold to that thought until our agonizing sense of incompleteness drives us past the mind and past the superficial intellectual understanding that this world gives us. I do not have a college degree. I went to 1 year of college. I was saying to someone yesterday, I actually went to about 1 week of college. I stayed for the year, but I really went to about a week, because in the first week, I realized that nobody there was looking for truth, or at least nobody that I was meeting. They were looking for intellectual entertainment, which I was quite capable of delivering. It was something I already knew. It was a samskar I was born with. But I wasn't interested in intellectual entertainment. What did this person think about it? And what did that person think about it? And how do you reconcile the two? And how do we make this work with that theory? And how do we balance that theory with this one? And never really taking a position, because we always have to, like this. I just was like, you've got to be kidding. So I went to parties and sort of had fun for a year and flunked out at the end. But what I wanted to know was, where are we? Why are we here? What's really going to make us happy? You see, that intellect, even that intellect, gathering all that knowledge, I mean, yes, if you can use it to serve others, yes, if it has some higher purpose. Swami Kriyananda was one of the most intelligent, most highly educated people I have ever known. But everything that he learned, he always turned it toward the divine purpose. You know, it was an event for which he was responsible, Swami Kriyananda, that's how he described it. That's how he thought of himself. I'm an event for which I am responsible, and I need to do it well. He would keep up with current events, he would keep up with economic situations, he would watch politics, not avidly, but as he said, I have a responsibility. I'm the leader of a large organization, and many people rely upon me. I can't afford to be ignorant. I need to know what's going on so that I can make intelligent decisions for the sake of serving others. Because that's how we begin to turn ourselves back into what we really are. For we are a part of all that is. And that is the only reason. Swami says that selfless service is the greatest way to overcome the ego. The simplest and the most effective. Because it constantly unites our self-interest, our energy, our time, and our money with the self-interest of all. And even more profoundly, when we give our energy, our time, and our money to a spiritual cause, then our energy is dedicated toward helping to enlighten others. The prayer of Ananda, which actually we don't use as often as we should, may the divine light awaken and purify my heart and bring enlightenment to all beings. Isn't that beautiful? Completely non-sectarian. It doesn't say anything about who's right and who's not. May the divine light awaken and then purify my heart. What is it purifying it from? That commitment to separateness. That's the impurity, is this commitment to separateness, to being incomplete, to rushing around restlessly trying to become whole. May the divine light awaken and purify my heart and bring enlightenment to all beings. Isn't that so simple? Weigh every decision, every thought, every action against that simple thought. You know, will this help me attune myself to divine light, to awaken and purify my heart? And how can I help to enlighten all beings? Because only when that reality is embraced, then will that agonizing sense that drives us away from God finally be fulfilled.